class tonight on dealing with dementia, as I titled it on the source sheets, or Judaism and Dementia Care, as the title appeared on the flyer, is dedicated in two different directions. First of all, I want to thank the Lipsitz family for dedicating the class in memory of Yehuda Zal Ben Yitzchak Halevi Veshifra Hashem Yikom Damam. And thank you for providing the refreshments for this evening. And then, in the wake of events of the last several days, our learning this evening is also dedicated for the safe and speedy freedom of Ayal, Gilad, and Naftali. The goal tonight is to try to provide some guidance, some background and guidance on issues related to dementia within Jewish law. I want to caution on two things. Number one, this is a very broad area of Jewish law, and I'm trying to address cases that I've been asked about before. In the event that you have a particular case you want to ask about, please feel free to contact me about it afterwards. Odds are I'm not going to be answering something on one foot here. That's quite a challenge to do, and I always recommend that for practical halacha, people ask their shul rabbi. Communities really should be relying upon the rabbi of the synagogue to set communal policy on issues. Number two, I'm doing well already. I find for myself that sometimes when I'm speaking on a topic and questions are being asked and the discussion is going forward, I can tend at times to lapse into being a little bit glib. And for some topics, you can do that and get away with it. And for some topics, that's really insensitive. And so I'm saying at the outset, I apologize in advance if I come across that way at any point. Know that it's not intentional, and I realize the seriousness of the topic that we're dealing with. You can see on your sheet, and for those who are on the email list for the medical halacha classes in general, you know that I'm expecting to address three categories of cases. I have a fourth ready in the event that there's enough time, but I suspect we won't get to it. The first category of cases is the issue of spending for the care of... Thank you very much. What is this?
Ginger ale.
Ginger ale. Excellent. Thanks. That's perfect. So the first is the issue of taking care and the expenses involved in caring for someone. And we'll see not just the financial expenses, but other expenses that go into it as well. Number two, the status within Jewish law of a person who is dealing with severe dementia and their obligation in mitzvot, their participation in the synagogue, that sort of category is the second category. And then third, I would like to get to the very difficult question of arranging housing and care for people with dementia and the question of putting someone in some kind of institution for care. What if they always said they didn't want to go into an institution, a child taking care of a parent, knowing that it's a very frustrating and challenging situation? Should they stick it out and say, well, we're going to do this at home or not? So that's what I want to deal with as the third case. The fourth and last, if there's time, then I would get into the questions that come up uniquely in terms of children providing care directly for their parents, issues of drawing blood, issues of intimate care. But I'm saving that for last because we've dealt with it in other contexts before. So it's not as pressing as some of these. But everyone's on the same page in terms of where we're going, what we're doing? Okay. All right. So... first of all, when we're talking about the costs involved in care, caring for a parent involves costs on many levels because it's a painful situation. There's no two ways around it. It pits both the patient and the caregiver against their natural inclinations in the sense that the parent remembers, I took care of you when you were a baby. And now I'm in a position where I am helpless and need you to take care of me. And that is in and of itself a terribly painful situation. And for the child also, it's painful. The child is also in a position of, you know, feeling like, well, that's my parent. Now I'm taking care of the parent. And that's odd psychologically. It's odd emotionally. It is extremely painful, particularly because we know the way things go with dementia and the children having difficulty seeing, you know, any sort of silver lining to what's going on or any kind of hope in the path that their parents are taking. Also, if you take a look at your source sheet, I saw a very interesting source quoted. Source number one, from the Vilna Gaon, Rabbi Eliyahu Kramer, writing at the end of the 18th century. He talks about the verse in Bereshit, in Genesis, which says that a person is supposed to leave his parents, vidavak bi'ishto, and stick to his wife. The man is supposed to stick to his wife. The spouses are supposed to cling to each other. And the Vilna Gaon writes, Moreh al inyan ba'alut v'lo amaseh ishut. He says, when it says that the man should stick to his wife, this doesn't mean sexually stick to his wife. It means it's as a husband, in the sense of taking care of her. Shekol yamav yetoreach va'amel al parnasasa. That a man's obligation is to strain and work to support his wife. V'lo al parnasas avveim, as opposed to supporting his parents. He's saying that the biblical statement is that one leaves his parents and then devotes himself to supporting a spouse. He's speaking in terms of the husband supporting the wife, and that's the ketubah obligation, where the man accepts that he is going to work and take care of his wife's needs. And so from that perspective, the children who have their own spouses and then their own children naturally feel like that's where their efforts should be going, and then now they have to turn that around and use it to support their parents. And however grateful they are dealing with the famous sandwich generation problem, where they have responsibilities to their kids and they also have responsibilities upwards to their parents. So this is tremendously difficult. From a financial perspective, the general view within Jewish law is that expenses come from the funds of the parents. Assuming there are such funds, expenses come from the funds of the parents, not from the funds of the children. And that's an understanding of the mitzvah of kibud av ve'im, of honoring one's parents. For anyone who's coming in now, there are still some source sheets over on the table by the refreshments. If you take a look at source number two, Rabbi Moses Maimonides, also known as Rambam, records an idea which is found already Talmudically a couple of thousand years ago. He writes, Mishel ha'av, that the money comes from the father, meaning the parent. Vim ein mamon la'av, v'yesh mamon la'ben. But if the parent doesn't have money, and the child does, then kofin oso v'zan aviv v'imo kifi mashehu yachol, then we compel the child to then support the parent. Ideally, it should come from the parent. If the parent doesn't have the means, then it comes from the child. And what the child is then doing is fulfilling the mitzvah of tzedakah. This is simply philanthropy, just like anybody supporting somebody else in need. So the child will do this on behalf of the parent. If you take a look at source number three, we fast forward in history. Maimonides writes that down. The Talmud records it a couple of thousand years ago. Maimonides writes it down in the 12th century. And then we fast forward to the very beginning of the 16th century and the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, and it describes the mitzvah of kibud av ve'im, of honoring one's parents, and it says, in source 3, Zeh shema'achilo u'mashkehu mishal av ve'im, feeding the parents comes from the parents' assets, im yeshlo, assuming that there are such assets. V'im ein la'av v'yesh la'ben, if the parent doesn't have, but the child has, Kofin oso vizan aviv kifi mashu yachol, then we compel the child to support the parent as he is able. Vim en leben, but what if the kid doesn't have? Eino chayav lachzar ala psachim lachil es aviv. We are not going to compel him to then go begging in order to get money for the parent. It's a communal responsibility to take care of this person. Rabbi Moshe Isserles wrote about 15, 20 years after the Code of Jewish Law came out. It was written by Rabbi Yosef Karo, who was living in Tzfat. He was originally from Turkey, and then he made Aliyah, and he lived in Tzfat. The Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in Krakow, writes the Ashkenazi portion of the Shulchan Aruch of the Code of Jewish Law, and he writes, continuing in source number 3, Ramah, V'yesh omrim de'eno chayev litein lo rak mashem chayev litein litzdakah. Some say the only thing then that the child is responsible to provide for the parent is that which you would normally provide for somebody in need as tzedakah, as philanthropy. Umikal makom im yado maseges tavo me'era lemisha mefarnes aviv mima'os tzedaka shalo. However, he says, if someone has the means to not use tzedaka funds on this, but use tzedaka funds for the community and use personal funds for the parents, that's the way it ought to be. The parents should not be looked upon as a so to speak, charity case. The parents should be looked upon as an extension of one's own life and one's own responsibilities. So that leads to a question. What happens if the child has the ability to support the parents? Yes. However, that means they won't necessarily be able to do everything they want for their children. Let's say they have the ability to secure great care for their parents, but as a result, they won't be able to afford day school tuition for their child. So now, what is expected of them within the framework of Jewish law? So take a look at source number 4. Rabbi Moshe Isserles writes, in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, Parnasas Atzmo Kodemes L'chal Adam, as a general rule, supporting oneself precedes supporting others. Ve'achar kach yagdim parnasas aviv v'imo im heim aniyim. Then comes support of one's parents, assuming they are needy. Ve'heim kodmim l'parnasas banav. And the parents precede one's own children. First, take care of your parents, then your kids. However, because there's always a however, nothing is ever as clear-cut as that. They take a look at source number 5. Rabbi Chalfon Moshe HaKohen, writing in the 19th century, adds a very important note. He says it depends on which type of children you're talking about. You can see it there in source number 5. I will say it outside the text. He says if you have small children, meaning children who are dependent on you, who are not old enough to make a living, then they come first. So what emerges from this is my primary obligation, first and foremost, is to support myself. In the event that I am able to eat, then my next obligation is to my children who are not of age to support themselves. And then the question is, well, what is of age to support yourself? So it's always funny because in the 17th century, the Shach, Rabbi Shabsei Cohen, commenting on the Code of Jewish Law, said the age of supporting yourself is basically 6, 7. Because you'd go out and you'd get an apprenticeship and that was the way you survived. Today, you know, we're probably talking 25. Graduate school, I don't know. But the responsibility of the parent is to take care of the child to the stage where the child will then can be expected to go out and get work. That's the second tier of responsibility. First yourself, then the child who is not expected to be independent. Then after that comes one's parent. After that comes the care of one's parent. Now, I cheated a little bit when I mentioned day school tuition, because there's a separate obligation for a parent to educate one's child in Torah. Whether that means full day school tuition or not is actually a more complex topic, but understand that there are responsibilities that the parent has towards the child which are actually personal and which aren't necessarily within this framework. But having addressed a little bit the financial obligations, one other piece that's very important here is to remember as a caregiver, and I think people know this, but it's always worth reiterating, the caregiver also has to look after himself, always has to look after herself. The people who burn themselves out are, number one, not doing the patient, you know, any service, and number two, they're seriously damaging themselves. It's important, the Torah says, v'nishmartem me'od l'nafsho seichem, you have to guard your life. It's important for the sake of your parent, and it's important for the sake of yourself. And I brought here a source which I found interesting from source number 6. Rabbi Lazar Popov, writing at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, defining chesed, generosity, and kindness. So after a series of comments that he makes about kindness towards others, he then says, "Ubiyoser v'yoser yigdal hachiyuv asos chesed im atzmo v'gufo." Even greater. And really, what I did in the English doesn't do it justice. He says, ubiyoser viyoser. That means greater and greater. Hachiyuv asos chesed im atzmo v'gufo is the obligation to perform chesed, acts of kindness, generosity, with one's self, with one's own body. And he quotes you a verse from Mishlei, from Proverbs, v'gomel nafsho ish chesed. One who gives to himself is a man of chesed. And he quotes a story regarding Hillel HaZaken, the famous Hillel the Elder. Shekeshaya holech le'echol, when he would go eat, Haya Omer Eloich ve'egmol chesed imachsanya sheyeshli. Dahainu nishmaso. He said, I'm going to go perform chesed for my guest. And by guest, he meant his soul. So the point is, supporting yourself is also an act of caring. It's also an act of generosity. And people should not feel guilty about the fact that they also need to look after themselves. Like I said, it's common sense. I'm sure people here know it. Nonetheless, I think it bears reiterating. In my life before coming to Toronto 5 years ago, I was a shul rabbi for a dozen years. And one thing that I always saw that really helped was when siblings who were going to be responsible to care for a parent would come up with a plan between themselves that everybody agreed to from the start of, this is how we're going to take care of needs, and then they would revisit it regularly. Not that it's going to solve all problems, because it won't, but it will help avoid misunderstandings and the resentment that comes with misunderstandings. Because otherwise, what very often happens is one child lives near the parent, or one child perhaps isn't working at a job with the same hours as the others, and they start doing the care, and they say, it's okay, I can take care of it. And the other siblings say, great, they have it under control, and we'll help wherever we can. But over time, life circumstances change. Over time, the responsibilities involved in care change. Or over time, simply the person says, you know what, this is too much for me. And then they're stuck. So it's very important for to try to mitigate that to the extent possible and try to revisit things. And also it's important to build in breaks, to build in breaks from the care, to find the opportunities to be able to not be on 24/7, and to whether that means a sibling, whether that means another relative, whether that means a friend, whether that means hiring somebody, but making sure that people have the ability to take that break is very important. Again, nothing new in what I'm saying, but I still think it's important to say it. So that's our first section, is in terms of the caregiver. Number one, the responsibility of funding is not on the children. It's primarily on using the parent's assets. In the event the parent doesn't have assets, then the child is supposed to do this, but with the recognition that they can use tzedakah money if they need to, number one. And number two, their children who are dependent on them, who are not of age to be independent, actually come first. Those are the key points in terms of the finances of this. Are there questions on that that I can address now? Yes. Same as the son. Same as the son. You're right. A lot of the wording is male because we don't have a neutral gender word, but the daughter as well.
And it's stuck a part of
it. Ditto.
Bert's stuck or her husband's stuck.
Well, that's an interesting question. In other words, would a son-in-law? But yeah, and for the son-in-law, it's even greater for him to be able to say that it's tzedakah from him because he has less of a personal, he has responsibility. In other words, sons-in-law, all jokes aside, have a responsibility of honoring their father-in-law and their mother-in-law. And daughters-in-law have a responsibility of, and when it says honor your father and mother, that includes in-laws. The best example of this is, where in the Torah? Well, Ruth does it for her mother-in-law, but before that, Moshe and Yitro, Moshe and his father-in-law. Moshe gives you great guidance on this matter, right? He welcomes his father-in-law, brings him in, makes a big party to welcome him. His father-in-law gives him advice. He nods. He listens to everything the father-in-law says, and then he sends him home. that's the glib part. The it would certainly qualify as a tzedakah expenditure. Chaim, you were going to ask.
Is there a difference between responsibility?
That's interesting. Is there a difference in the responsibility between a firstborn child and other children? I don't believe so. I think the responsibility is shared equally among the kids. Okay, so let's move to the second area here. And that is halachic obligations. The obligations in Jewish law of a person with dementia. So we have discussed on other occasions the three different categories of incapacity that are recognized within Jewish law. We've discussed them at length. I'm not going to go into it at length here. Just briefly to summarize, there is the category called the shote. A shote is a person who is irrational, may be sharp. The person might be sharp, but the person is irrational in the sense that they don't have the ability to string together a logical thought process. That's one possibility. The second possibility is someone who is called petty. Petty means someone of poor comprehension. And then there's the person who is nechpaz. And nechpaz means someone who is hasty, who rushes his thought process and reaches inappropriate conclusions. Those are the three general categories of incompetence. For example, take a look at source number 7 from Maimonides. He's discussing who is a valid witness and what is acceptable as testimony in court. And Maimonides writes, "Hapitaim bioter, those who are especially foolish," and that's that category of petty that I mentioned. "She'ein makirin dvarim shesosim zed zed." They don't recognize contradictory statements. You say two different things and they don't realize that they're contradictory because they have poor comprehension. "V'lo yavinu inyanei hadavar kederach shemivinim sha'ar am ha'aretz." They don't understand matters as other people do. "V'chein ha'mevohalim v'hanechpazim b'da'atam," as well as people who are confused and hasty in their minds. And that's the third category, the nechpaz. So he says, "Hare elu bichlal hashotim." These people are all within the category, like the person who is irrational, the shote, of being ineligible to testify in terms of what he's talking about. But then he says, it's really hard to define this by writing out a set of symptoms and saying, if the person displays these symptoms, then you know that they are irrational. It's very hard to do that. The Talmud has a few symptoms, but the commentators discuss whether those are specific or just examples. Rambam Maimonides himself writes, "V'davar zeh lefi she'yira hadayon, she'yashu l'chavein adas bichtav." He says it's the way the judge sees it. You can't specify it in writing and give symptoms that will work across the board. You know it when you see it, is his approach. So the statement is that people may become incompetent in terms of Jewish law, and therefore they may potentially be exempt from responsibilities under Jewish law if they fit one of these categories. So how do we view somebody with dementia? Well, there are stages of dementia, right? It's not all one thing. But let's assume we're talking about somebody who has advanced to the point where she forgets what day it is. He forgets where he is or who the people around the patient are, looks at them and doesn't know who they are. Someone like that. So Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein, in an article called Ma'amado Shel Halokeh B'Nafsho B'Yachas La'Anisha U'Masa U'Matan, which I quote you in source number 9, and if anyone wants to see it, I gave you the web link there. For those who have the digital source sheet, you can just click on it, as opposed to here, you'd have to retype it. But again, this is a plug for signing in. I will, God willing, email out the source sheet after the class so that those who didn't have it in advance will have a digital copy, and then you can click on this and see the article. In any case, make sure you sign in with your email address. But what Rabbi Zilberstein writes in source number 9 is as follows. Umistaber, he says, it's logical to say, Shazaken shadato mibulbelas hu bichlal nitrafa da'ato. An elder whose mind is confused is in the category that Maimonides called a torn mind. Vim eno mismatze hecha nimtza ve'eno makiras krovav, when he doesn't know where he is, he doesn't recognize his relatives. Hare dino kishote upasul lakol. So he is now called a shote. He is now called irrational for our purposes. And he is disqualified in the sense that that means he couldn't perform a mitzvah on behalf of somebody else. And he's not obligated, as we'll see, in mitzvot either. Ulam, im yodea es hahoveh. But if he currently knows where he is, he knows what's going on. Elisha sovel mishichacha ve'eno zocher hechan haya etmol. Uma asal lefnei kama sha'ot. If all that happens is he doesn't remember where he was yesterday, he doesn't remember what he did a few hours ago, he doesn't remember what he had for breakfast, dino kipikeach. So in the eyes of Jewish law, that person is considered to be fully functional and aware. They, even though his memory is poor. Ulam le'edus pashut shepasul, except we're not going to accept him as a witness, because if he doesn't remember what happened a few hours ago, we won't really want him testifying on the stand. So testimony aside, in the eyes of Jewish law, if he knows where he is now, he is a full member of the Jewish people for all halachic issues, all matters of Jewish law. If he doesn't understand what's going on right now, then he is exempt. Okay. As an aside, we're not going to discuss now. I did discuss it in another class on elder care. We're not going to discuss now a key question, which is, let's say a person is in this category. We say that this person does not, in fact, comprehend what's going on around him. He doesn't know where he is. He doesn't know who the relatives around his bed are. So who makes decisions on his behalf? Is he going to make decisions for himself? Or is somebody else going to be the one to make decisions for him? So in such a case, again, we've discussed this at length before, but in such a case, the family is entrusted with making these decisions using what's called substituted judgment. Substituted judgment means that they have to determine it based on what that person would have wanted. That's very important because you have two different systems. One is for me to say, I think this is good for the patient. The other, substituted judgment, is when you say this is what the patient wanted. And they're supposed to go with the system of substituted judgment, asking, what did this person want for themselves? I brought you a Moshe Feinstein on it in source number 10. You can take a look at it yourself. So having said that the patient with dementia that is severe enough that they don't comprehend what's going on, they don't recognize the people around them, that this patient is now exempt from mitzvot, one might be tempted to say, well, then all bets are off. No Shabbos, no Yom Kippur, no Kashrus. They can just, you know, live as they are. So number one, that may not be a healthy thing to do to them. And the reason I say that is because on some level, you know, if someone lived 60, 70, 80 years practicing certain things, doing certain things, even if they're not fully aware of what's going on, they may have a measure of comfort from those experiences. So for them to be in shul, even if they have zero obligation, may be very good for them. For them to be sitting at a Shabbos table and songs are being sung and the traditional foods are being eaten and there are candles there on the table, that may be an incredibly therapeutic experience, even if they have no obligation to be there at all. So that's something that's very important to keep in mind when working with someone who's in this situation, when caring for them. That's number one. Number two, laws aren't always so clear-cut in general. So for example, we're going to look at the question of Kashrut, of keeping kosher. Take a look, please, at source number 11. Rav Moshe Sternbach, a contemporary writer, talks about feeding a baby. And he notes, b'ma'achalos asuros, when you're dealing with prohibited foods, foods that are not kosher, asur latet lekatan ben yomo, mishum shema'achal isur pogembo. He says you can't even give non-kosher food to a day-old child who is certainly not obligated in mitzvot because it's bad for him. And what he's suggesting is an idea found in Midrashic writing that suggests that non-kosher food is actually in some way bad for the Jewish soul. What this means requires a mystic to explain it. I am not a mystic. I do not have the ability to. I only know that it's on the books. And so therefore, we avoid giving somebody non-kosher food, even if technically they're not required to keep kosher. Now, what if that's the only food for them? What if they need a particular diet and this is the only thing that's available? That's a different story. I'm not talking about giving it to them as medicine. I'm talking about just in general, in terms of feeding them, if someone has the opportunity to provide kosher food, you have an institution that you can put them into, which will provide them with kosher food. So you don't say, well, that's okay. They're so gone in their dementia that they're not obligated anyway. We still try to provide them with kosher food. That's number one. Holidays. What about eating matzah on Pesach? Would they be obligated in eating matzah on Pesach? So the answer seems to be that they are exempt, although I do note for you source number 12. Rabbi Yisrael Meir HaKohen, better known as the Chafetz Chaim or as the Mishneh Berurah, wrote a little over 100 years ago that in general, when you're talking about the mitzvah of eating matzah on Pesach, eating matzah on Passover, he said the definition of eating is what we call in Hebrew, hana'at garon, the benefit of the throat. So if the person's throat benefits, so to speak, he's doing normal eating, you're not forcing him to eat it, but he's chewing and swallowing, then there is an element of a mitzvah involved. Now, the truth is that's questionable here, where the person really doesn't understand at all what's going on. Is that really going to meet the standard to be called a mitzvah of eating matzah? That's a little bit tricky. It's not so clear-cut. Certainly, I would not want to see somebody compel them to eat it out of a sense that somehow this is, you know, something that should be done. But if they're okay eating it, if it's not going to harm them to eat it, then I would say, so let them have some matzah. It doesn't, assuming it's not going to hurt, in order to do so. I would not think that one should press it on them, though. We're still going through this list, but if at some point someone wants to ask a particular question, you can go ahead, because there are a few more items that I have on the list. I don't want people to forget what they're asking. Well, okay. Here's an interesting one. Between Pesach and Shavuos, Passover and Shavuot, I could say Pentecost, but it's not going to translate Shavuot. We have a mitzvah of counting the Omer. For 49 days, each night, one counts the Omer and says, today is day one, today is day two, today is day three, and so on. There are two different ways to view this mitzvah. The mitzvah itself stems back to an offering that's brought when there is a Beit HaMikdash, when there's a temple in Jerusalem. There was one offering brought on the second day of Passover. There's another offering brought on Shavuot, and we count 49 days in between. Currently, we don't have a Beit HaMikdash, we don't have a temple, and the practice is rabbinic to remember what was done in the times of a temple. When it will be rebuilt, it will be a biblical mitzvah once again. So there are two different ways to look at this mitzvah, though. One way to look at the mitzvah is that it's one long mitzvah. Every night I count until at the end I reach 49, I have performed one big mitzvah. Another view is that there's an individual mitzvah every single night. So we tend to assume that it should be viewed as one long mitzvah, so that if I forget a night, night 27, I forgot to count, then I lost my opportunity. I should still count on the other nights, but I don't recite a blessing anymore on that counting. So here's the question. You have somebody who's experiencing dementia. Right now, day three, let's say, they know what's going on and they can count. But when you hit, let's say, day 12, you don't know if it's going to be the same way because they sort of fade in and out. Sometimes they're more lucid, sometimes they're less so. Should they be reciting a blessing on this, knowing that later on in the Omer, they may not get it, they may not realize what's going on? So the recommendation tends to be for them to count without a blessing. Because let them count, but don't encourage them to recite a blessing on it. Okay. Bringing someone to shul. When the person is dealing with dementia that's severe enough that they may not realize where they are, right? They may start talking really loudly to the person next to them. I'm not dealing right now with the problem of continence. That's its own question. But but let's say they may not act in a way that's appropriate for the synagogue. I said talk loudly to the person next to them. I realize that, you know, that doesn't require dementia. In some way, they may act out such that it's going to disturb. So do you bring them to the synagogue? Or do you say, look, they're exempt? On the one hand, if they can still recognize the space and take joy from being there, that's where they've gone every week for umpteen years, then you want them to be there in the synagogue. And especially if they're aware enough that, let's say, they can kiss the Torah. They can do something. There is a mitzvah element to it. So some write that because of the potential for disturbance, they should not be brought. And this goes back to a response from Rabbi Moshe Sofer, writing in the 18th century. Rabbi Moshe Sofer was asked about someone who was epileptic and subject to seizures in the synagogue. And he said, better for them not to go. He was writing at a time when people believed that someone who sees another person have a seizure would himself be psychologically and emotionally harmed by observing the seizure. They're worried there's a woman who's pregnant and she witnesses the seizure and it can cause her some harm. So he said better to stay away. However, if it's reasonable to assume that number one, they're going to be all right, and number two, that those who are sitting there will be okay dealing with whatever happens, then it's a very good thing to actually have them there within the shul. I should note, I added here, take a look at source number 13. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein wrote a response to him. He's not dealing with a case of dementia in source number 13. He's dealing with a case of bringing a child to the synagogue when the child is developmentally disabled. And the child is someone who is not going to be obligated in mitzvot. And what he writes is, I'm going to read the English in the interest of time, but you can see the Hebrew there. When they come to the synagogue, the congregation must greet them pleasantly. Even when they cannot learn with the community, they must see to it that such children answer Amen and Kedusha, saying it with them so that they will do what they can and so as to honor their parents. This has value for the children themselves, as they fulfill whatever they can, or even walking to synagogue, as even walking to synagogue is a mitzvah, and they can kiss the Torah scroll. So he says there's value for the kids who go, and there's value for the parents in that case who bring them, and the community should make them and their parents feel welcome. Again, he's dealing with the case of a child, but I believe that the same rule is going to apply when it's one bringing one's parent into the synagogue. What about fasting on Yom Kippur? So the general rule is that they are exempt. There is a question which arises within Jewish law in this context. Rabbi Avram Gambiner, in source number 14, talks about feeding a child on Yom Kippur. We know that children are not supposed to fast until they reach the age of 11 or 12. At the age of 11 or 12, they're supposed to fast for several hours, enough that they have a sense of what fasting is, but they don't actually fast until they are of age. Even though children who are underage will often say, but I want to fast because they want to be cool like the adults. Go figure. Nonetheless, there's no obligation for children to start fasting before they're obligated to do so. However, Rabbi Avram Gambiner, author of a classic commentary to the Code of Jewish Law in the 17th century, has a problem. He says, we know you're not supposed to feed non-kosher food to somebody. So he says, why are you able to feed them on Yom Kippur? He says, it appears to me in source 14 that one should not give them to eat, as that would be like actively giving them nevela, non-kosher food, for eating is prohibited, he says. He says, I'm not allowed to feed them. However, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan in source 15 qualifies that comment, and he says it depends on the age. If you're dealing with a child of 11 or 12, that child actually has an obligation to start fasting. That, he says, is when it's true that you shouldn't actively feed them, let them take the food themselves. But when the child is under that age, is younger than that age, there's no mitzvah for the child to do any fasting. And therefore it's fine to feed them, he says. And the same rule is going to apply, writes Rav Moshe Sternbach, when you're dealing with somebody who is experiencing dementia, which is, you're not going to, at that stage, say they have any sort of obligation. They don't. And because they don't have any obligation, there's nothing wrong with feeding them directly. So on Yom Kippur, you would take whatever food it is and actively feed the person with dementia. Rabbi Sternbach adds that there are other reasons to make sure that you take care of this person. If you take a quick look at source number 16, Rabbi Sternbach writes, in my humble opinion, he says, there is another reason to permit, meaning to permit feeding him. Perhaps the fast disturbs and endangers him, and he can't say it because of his situation, meaning the person who's experiencing dementia may well be suffering from the starvation and not be able to express it, and you're not going to know. And he adds, one also can't feed him minimal quantities through the day. You know, there's the approach of we'll break the fast, but not too badly. We'll give them tiny quantities of food, less than an olive-sized amount, less than a date-sized amount, and that way they'll make it through the day. He says, you can't do that. because you have no feedback from the person to know what their status is. So he says you feed them normally on Yom Kippur. You have a question? It seems that there is no difference. That is correct. The child who was never obligated and the adult who was experiencing dementia seem to be put into the same category, like Rabbi Sternbach does regarding Yom Kippur. Yes. Yes.
What's the role of the substitute decision maker insofar as the ensuring that the maximum benefit or potential for commission of mitzvot are, as opposed, or to put it, the corollary, creating a situation where the opportunity to make mitzvot is limited by decisions that the substitute decision maker makes?
So an example would be, let's say, moving them...
A parent in a home that may not necessarily offer kashrut and religious ritual practices.
Right. So... because of the sensitivity on some of the issues, like the kashrut issue, where we say that even if they're exempt from the obligation to keep kosher, nonetheless, we're still supposed to give them kosher food where possible, we generally will avoid putting them into a home where they can't get kosher food, to use that as the example. So that's one consideration. And again, I'm assuming that there's a safe place where they can take care of them. You know, sometimes, let's say a person has a tracheotomy, and only certain places can actually take care of them. You can't find one that serves kosher food, but that's where they're going to be taken care of. Then that's the way it is, and you do the best you can to deal with the situation. But we would always err on the side of putting them in a position where they are able to observe whatever they can, to the extent that there's going to be, again, to the extent that there will be a benefit to them from it, and to the extent that there may be an obligation in certain cases. So if there's no benefit to them from it, they are so unaware that sitting at a Shabbos table is meaningless to them. They're not, you know, they're not going to a Shabbos table. They may be bedbound altogether. So obviously that lessens the imperative.
You keep saying value to the person.
So
you can't possibly know having kashrut or eating kashrut or whatever whether they benefit from it or not. So the substitute decision maker is the one that's making those choices. So then my real question is what expectation does Halacha have of the SDM?
Right. So that's a good question. The question he's asking is, in a case where you can't tell anything, there's no way to tell any benefit for them. In other words, we're talking about someone whose dementia is already severe. So they're not responding, and we're not able to know. Again, recognizing that we still don't like giving people non-kosher food, so that isn't a class unto itself. But it would appear to me that once a person has reached that point, the other issues are no longer issues. The other issues of, you know, let's have them eat matzah, or let's have them, come to the synagogue, those seem to be less relevant. The kashrut stands on the side because we don't want to feed people something non-kosher if we can at all avoid it, regardless of their state. But in terms of these others, that the situation you're describing sounds to me like that now, those other possibilities are no longer a factor. So it would appear to me. Yes. There was a hand up over here. Yeah.
I was going to ask where the power of attorney, the personal care, fits in. He wishes that the person is exempted.
Right. Yes, that's a really good point. And actually, I had written it into my notes earlier, and then I saw my note as I was going through it and said, I'm going to get back to it later, and now I'm getting back to it. It is very, very important. First of all, this is just a plug. It is very, very important for people to have a power of attorney, which they sit down and discuss with their family members before anything reaches this stage. It is an unintentional cruelty for people not to prepare one. and not to discuss it with their family, because the result, unfortunately, very often then, is that people are left to fend for themselves, trying to figure out what their relative wanted in very difficult ethical situations. And they don't know what's best and what should I have done, what shouldn't I have done, and they'll torment themselves, the relatives. So it's very important, without discussing, I'm not even talking about what the decisions are going to be that are in the power of attorney. I'm not talking about what you're going to tell them to do or not do, but at least let the relatives know what it was that what it was that the person wanted. That to me is critical. And having said that, to a certain extent, the power of attorney will rule. So, for example, if the patient said, I mean, this doesn't normally appear in a power of attorney, but if someone had the foresight to say that in the event of severe dementia, they don't want to be brought out of the house to the synagogue because they'd be embarrassed for everybody to see them, whatever their reason is, then you don't bring them. Then you say, okay, this I respect and honor the decision that they made. So in that sense, it will you know, carry great weight. But thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak about the power of attorney, because it wouldn't have been good for me to skip that. Other questions on Jewish law before we get on to the very thorny question of housing for somebody with dementia? Okay, so then we move on to our third category, and the issue of housing for people who are experiencing dementia and the issue of the nursing home. As I put it on your sheet, he always insisted he didn't want to be in a nursing home. What should I do? So children have a mitzvah, we know, of kibud av va'em, of honoring their parents. And that remains regardless of the state of dementia of the parent. The child's obligation will remain. The Talmud discusses various cases in which parents experienced what seems to be some form of dementia, and their children continue to honor them, and the children are held up as models for what one ought to do. So we have this idea of honoring one's parents. Further, there's a general mitzvah beyond parents of kavod habrios, of honoring all people. And that certainly is going to apply in taking care of one's parents. So keeping that in mind as the framework with which we approach this, what happens if a parent is experiencing dementia? The son, let's say it's a son, wants to take the parent into the home, and his wife objects, or vice versa. Doesn't matter, son or daughter in this case. What happens at that stage? So take a look on your sheet at source number 17, please. Rabbi Moses Maimonides, the Rambam, writes the following. Ha'omer le'ishto, if a man says to his wife, Ein ritzoni she'yavo'u le'beisi, avich v'imech, achayech v'achiyotayech. If a man says to his wife, I don't want your father, your mother, your brothers, your sisters, I don't want them entering my home. Shom inlo. We listen to him. They can't come in. How does she get to see her parents? And again, this works both ways. It's not male or female specific. So then what's supposed to happen? Tiyahi halachas lahem kishayar lahem davar. If they need something, if something happens to them, so she goes to them. But they can be blocked from the home. The only requirement that Maimonides does state, which I skipped in the interest of space in the ellipsis here, is that if it's the if the objection comes from the spouse who doesn't own the home, in other words, the home is owned by one of them, and it's the other one who's objecting, then the one who's objecting is required to prove that there's grounds for this concern of I don't want them there because when they come visit, they do this, or we can't deal with that, or whatever it is. If it's the objection comes from the one who doesn't own the house, they're responsible to come up with support for their argument. But then he continues. Hang on one second. V'lo yikansu heim la, elem ira la davar kigon choli ole da. The only way in which they would be allowed to enter the home if this objection exists is if their child is very ill or gives birth or something so that they can't go to visit. So then we say they can enter, but otherwise not, because we don't compel a person to allow somebody else into their space. That's the statement. Question?
You get a situation where the children have a grudge against the parent, or the parent has disowned the children. What obligation do the children have?
They are still obligated to honor the parent, even where the parent has disowned them. Yeah. The only case where we may say otherwise are cases of abuse, which are unique and different and involve other health issues in terms of requiring of them that they do this sort of thing for the parent. But otherwise, the obligation to honor exists regardless of the treatment of the parent. So Maimonides says you can object to having your in-laws come into the house, even though we said you have to honor them and all that. Nonetheless, you can object to having them come into the house, and this is ruled in the Shulchan Aruch in the Code of Jewish Law. So that objection can happen. What about the case that I gave you as the heading here? Putting somebody into a nursing home when the patient always said, I don't want it. So we recognize within Jewish law that it's bad to leave one's surroundings. In source number 18, I gave you a responsum that dealt with an interesting situation. It was a case of two widows. There was an agreement that was made between two women. We call them Rachel and Leah. And the deal was that Rachel had paid Leah money now, and it was in exchange for support that Leah would give her later, that Leah should live in Rachel's home and take care of her. In other words, Rachel is older than Leah. She said, listen, I'm going to give you some money now. I'm going to get older. I'm going to need someone to take care of me. You'll come live in my house in exchange for the money that I'm giving you now. It's sort of a healthcare insurance policy, more or less. That's the idea, except that the Maharam Meirutenberg is talking about this 600-700 years ago. So that was the deal. Then what happened was Leah moved overseas. And Leah says, if Rachel wants me to care for her, she's going to have to come move overseas to be with me. Leah cannot compel Rachel to come live with her in this distant land for the fulfillment of the contract because people don't want to leave the place that they are familiar with. It's considered to be detrimental for them to leave the place they're familiar with. Rabbi Yigal Shaffron wrote an article several years ago in a journal called Tehumen in which he traced this back to the story of Barzilai HaGiladi. Barzilai, his story appears in Shmuel Bet, Samuel 2, chapter 19, was an ally of King David. And when King David moves to Yerushalayim, to Jerusalem, he says to Barzilai, come live with me. I'll take care of you. And Barzilai says to him, I'm 80 years old already. I don't want to burden other people. I just want to be in the place that I am familiar with. So there, in biblical text, you have the foundation of this idea that people really don't want to be outside of their home. So based on that, you'd say, care for the person in their house. Don't put them into a home. However, if you can't handle the needs of the patient, that may well be the best option. Take a look, please, at source number 19, a classic story that must be discussed anytime you deal with this issue. The story of Rav Asi. I'm going to do it in the English in the interests of time. You can see the Hebrew there. Rav Asi's elderly mother said, I want jewelry. He made jewelry for her. She said, I want the man. He said, okay, I'll go find you a shidduch. Fine, Ma. She said, no, I want one as good as you. And at that point, he left and he went to Israel. Packs up, leaves town, says, I'm making aliyah. He then heard that she was coming after him. And at that point, he turns to Rabbi Yochanan, his mentor, and says, may one leave Israel? The rule ordinarily is that one is not allowed to leave the land of Israel other than for particular purposes. Am I supposed to move back? What am I supposed to do? Rabbi Yochanan replied, no, don't leave. He said, what about going to greet my mother? Rabbi Yochanan says, I don't know. He delayed for a bit, and then he came back to Rabbi Yochanan, who said, look, Asi, if you want to go back, may God return you there in peace. By then, news comes that his mother's casket has arrived for burial in Israel. She passed away. He said, had I known, I would not have left. Now, this story is vague on many levels, but particularly the ending. I wouldn't have left what? Is he saying, had I known that she was going to pass away from this, I wouldn't have left home? Or is he saying, had I known she was going to pass away, I would have stayed in Israel and I wouldn't have left to try to come greet her? It's not at all clear. But take a look at what Maimonides does with this story. Source number 20. He writes, still following in the English, if one's father or mother develops dementia, he should try to act according to their wishes until God has mercy upon them. And notice the vague phrase, until God has mercy upon them. That's intentionally so. If he cannot bear it, because they have become extremely irrational, as in the case of Rav Asi's mother, he should leave and instruct others to manage them in the manner befitting them. If he can't do it, he should get other people to help. That's Maimonides' position. Now on that, Rabbi Avram ibn Daud, also known as Ravid, whose job it is in life to disagree with Maimonides, says this is an incorrect... It's not true. He has other commentaries in which he disagrees with other people. But in his commentary on Maimonides, his job is to disagree with Maimonides. So he says, this is, he says, an incorrect ruling. Why? Because if the kid's going to go and leave his parent, who's he going to instruct to take care of the parent? His objection is, how is he going to get other people to do this? So I used this in the longer lecture that we had on the topic of elder care. I'm not going to go into it in great length right now. But it is generally understood that Ravid's objection is not relevant in the world of today. Because in the world that we live in today, we have professional people to take care. In other words, the Ravid's assuming if the person's own child says, this is too much for me, then who are they going to get who's going to do this and do it properly? But today, there are people who do this professionally. One could turn to someone who does it professionally and say, please, I'd like you to be the one to do this, and you pay them money, and they'll do it better than the child would have done it. Take a look at the Code of Jewish Law in source number... No, I didn't bring it on the sheet, I'm sorry. But in the Code of Jewish Law, in the Shulchan Aruch, he indeed follows the view of Maimonides and says that that if you reach a point where the child is not able to take care of the parent properly, then the child does put the parent into a facility. Now, what happened to the fact that the parent refused all those years? So Rabbi Yigal Shafran, in his article on this in the journal Tehumen, points out that the obligation to save lives applies even when it comes to someone who is trying to commit suicide. If someone is trying to end his life, I see someone who's about to jump off a bridge, I am obligated to go try to save them. So he says, you know, the parent may say, I don't want to go into the facility. But if I can't take care myself, if the child is not able to provide proper care, then you say, I'm sorry. You know, I wish it were otherwise, but I don't have the ability to take proper care of you. Now, you need to be careful about how you do it. You don't frighten them. You do it with, to the extent possible, their participation in the process so that it's not simply something that's foisted upon them. But at the end of the day, if they are refusing and the child just says, I don't have the ability to do this, then it's legitimate for the child to put them into a facility. There's more on this in a very interesting article written in 1990 by Barry Freundel. The article is called Halacha and the Nursing Home Dilemma. It's in the Proceedings of the Association of Orthodox Jewish Scientists. You can actually find it, I believe, online, and it's worth looking at. But now let me ask you the tough question. I assumed that we're talking about a child who physically can't handle the parent's needs. There are medical conditions that require constant treatment. The child doesn't know how to give injections. You know, that kind of a situation. But what about a case in which the child can do it physically, but the child knows himself, herself, well enough to know that they're going to get aggravated, they're going to get frustrated, and at some point, being human beings, they're going to lash out, even if it's not physically, but verbally. And, you know, the laws of kibbutz av'eim, the laws of honoring one's parents, require a high degree of respect. So at that point, what does the child do? Do we say to the child, tough it out, keep them in your house, and you know, deal with the challenge as best you can? Or do we say, no, that's grounds for putting them into a facility? So there is a law recorded in the Code of Jewish Law in source number 21 on a separate topic, which sheds light on this. Source number 21. The Code of Jewish Law is talking about lending money to somebody. There is a biblical law that says that if somebody borrows money from me, and I know they don't have the means to pay it back, lo tihye lo kinoshe, I am not allowed to go to that person and act as a lender to them, making them feel miserable for the fact that they can't pay me back. That's prohibited behavior. If I know they don't have the means, I can't make their lives miserable. So in that context, look at source 21. One may not accept a loan and waste it, this is on the borrower, to the point that the lender will have nothing from which to collect. One who does so is wicked. But then it says, a lender who knows that the borrower would do this, if you know that the borrower is going to squander what you're lending, then don't lend to him. Rather than lend and then need to oppress him, violating Shmot, Exodus, you shall not be an oppressor, each time. If I know that if I lend this person money, he's going to squander it, and then he's going to default, and then I'm going to be in a position where I'm going to be an oppressor to him as I come back to him for it, because that's my nature, then I'm better off not lending him money in the first place. So is brought in the Code of Jewish Law. So with that in mind, Rabbi Eliezer Zilberstein, in his Chashuk Echemed commentary to Bava Metzia, says, taking care of your parents isn't quite analogous, because extending a loan to a person who doesn't pay back is voluntary. There's no mitzvah to do it. There's no prohibition against doing it. It's a voluntary thing. Taking care of your parents, though, is obligatory. So I won't quite parallel it to this case to say that just like you don't lend money to somebody who's going to put you in a bad position, so too you don't take a parent into your home if it's going to put you in a bad position. They're not entirely analogous, because you do have an obligation to take care of your parents. But if you know that you're going to be in this situation, there is room to contend that you're justified in not entering to it in the first place. The Chashuk Echemed, Rabbi Zilberstein, does not like that. Rabbi Zilberstein says in the end, you should take them into your home and deal with it. But not everybody agrees. The Yalkut Yosef, which is a major source of contemporary law for Sephardic Jews, says no. He says you actually should put the parent into a facility where they could take care of them properly. And he brings a story from the Chazon Ish, Rabbi Avram Yeshaya Karelitz, a major authority in Jewish law in Israel in the first half of the 20th century, in which he was asked by a student about precisely this case. And the answer given by the Chazon Ish was that one should not keep the parent in his home, knowing that it's going to lead him to stumble. Better to have the parent taken care of in a separate place. One last case, and then I'll take questions. One last case. What if you have the following case? There's a man and a woman. They're married to each other, husband and wife, and they have a child. And the child is living in the home with the parents. And let's say it's the mother whose needs are becoming great. The child says, I can take care of the mother in the home. However, his father, the husband, is having difficulty. He's becoming frustrated and aggravated by having his wife there because of her dementia. So he says, I can't do this. What does the child now do? On the one hand, he has an obligation to honor his mother, and he's trying to fulfill that, and he's physically capable of doing it, physically, emotionally capable of taking care of his mother in the house. But his father, who's aging as well, can't deal with it. So Rabbi Zilberstein dealt with this case as well, and he quoted his father-in-law, Rabbi Yosef Shalom Elyashiv, on the topic. And he says, if you take a look at source number 22, the last source on the sheets, He says, we know that a husband is obligated to provide a dwelling for his wife and to provide medical care. And he may not provide a dwelling which will harm her health. That's a rule. When a man and a woman get married in the ketubah, the man is obligated to provide a place for his wife to live. He is obligated to provide medical care. All true. However, what he then adds, quoting his father-in-law, Rabbi Eliashiv, is that the place for somebody suffering from Alzheimer's, in the case that he's dealing with, is an elder facility where they're expert and they know how to take better care of her. So he says, it's not inappropriate to say we need her to be in a facility. And based on that, his ruling was to actually go to the facility, even though the child was able to do so, because it then harms the spouse. And fundamentally, the obligation of the spouse is taken care of in the facility as well. That was his position. But to sum up what we've said in terms of this this last category, yes, children are obligated to honor their parents. And yes, that should include taking care of the needs of the parents in the home, ideally. At the same time, number one, one's spouse is able to object to doing that in the home. Number two, the spouse of the person with dementia, the last case, is also able to object. What about taking care of a parent in the home where it's just beyond your ability to do so? You can't manage it anymore. So in that case, even if the parent didn't want to go to the facility, nonetheless, that's the appropriate thing to do. And what about where a child is not able to do it in terms of honoring the parents? One horrific case, and it's horrific, but it happens. Was asked, I think it was by Eliezer Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, who was asked this question. Child said, I am able to take care of my parent, except that I can't feed them. The only way that I can feed them is if I fasten them into a chair with restraints. That's the only way that I'm able to do it. So he said, you need to get someone who is professional to do it, because that is a violation of the honor due to one's parents, and at that point, it's time to get somebody professional who actually is able to take care of it. So that will, in the end, override the obligation to honor one's parents. That's the concluding part of this. But if anybody is going to leave, please do make sure to sign in. Where are the sign-in sheets right now? There's one over here. There's another one somewhere else. There's another one back there. Just if anyone didn't get a chance to, I want to be able to follow up on items, and I want you to be able as well to email me. So if you sign in, you'll have my email address, because I'm going to email you afterwards. Questions on this section? Yes. According to Rav Eliashiv, right. So I don't think he's necessarily saying that all other things being equal, this is the best. In other words, if you had the ability to take care of them properly in home, and there is no discomfort in doing so, it's just as good, and in certain ways better than, the facility. He did say that the facility is, so to speak, the place. He says, Hamakom shelisha sovelet me Alzheimer hu bebeit avot. So he was very clear saying that that's an appropriate place. However, given the benefit that comes from being at home with people you know, with people who know you, I don't think he would say, do that as your first option. I think he's saying it's a legitimate backup option. That would be my understanding. I would have a hard time accepting the idea that this would be a first option. Yes?
On the subject of Kibbutz Av V'Em, in light of what I've heard you say, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on the different standard, the objective standard versus the subjective standard.
Yeah.
The objective standard would have us behave a certain way as caregivers and as children, whether that means bringing them to simchas, bringing them out to seders and dinners and gifts, and just the general treatment. On the subjective standard, a person with severe dementia is completely unaware of a lot of these things. And on a personal scale, I'm always struggling with, do I do this? Am I doing it for me? Or am I doing it for my mother? Because if it's about my mother, that's the subjective standard of kibbud ad va'em, she wouldn't care one way or the other, or at least my knowledge.
Right.
But if I do it on the objective standard, which is what would the world think, what do I think, then I would behave a different way.
Right. So as a general rule, have not even dealing with a case of dementia, but in general, in honoring one's parents, the mitzvah is understood to be subjective. So much so, the Talmud states that you can have a child who gives a parent fine pheasant and makes the parent miserable, and that person is doing the antithesis of honoring the parents. He makes them feel terrible that they're accepting this gift from him, and he gives it to them with a scowl. And then on the other hand, it says, you could have a child who puts the parent to the mill and makes them grind the flour for the bread that he's going to make them. But he explains, look, this is what we need right now. I'm so sorry. And he does it in a nice way. And that person is considered to be fulfilling the mitzvah of honoring a parent. Honoring one's parents is decidedly subjective. So it is going to matter.
Who's subjective?
To the parent personally.
The honoring?
No, the honoree, to the parent. It's a matter of what the parent is going to benefit from. Parents have the ability to forgive their honor on issues. So, for example, the Talmud mentions that one function of honor is that you don't sit in the parent's seat. But if the parent says, you know, it's okay, I'm happy for you to sit there, then you can sit there. So it is based on the viewpoint of the parent. And as far as what other people are going to think, you know, that's...
So can I just ask a follow-up question? So
yeah.
For those that are actually doing the power of attorney or a will, would it not behoove them to lower the standard so that what the caregiver does is always going to exceed, as opposed to have a standard that is so high that it might not be met?
So here you introduce a very important point, which is, people don't necessarily express that which they're really feeling, which is a shock, I know. But you may have a situation in which the parent says, I'm now writing up the power of attorney, and I want to tell my children, because I don't want them to bother, you can leave me at home, you don't need to take me to birthday parties, you don't need to take me to shul, you don't need to whatever it is. But the truth of the matter is that the parent would actually be very happy there. And while it's not fair exactly to put children in the situation of being a mind reader, that's reality in much of life having nothing to do with dementia. Yeah. So I think that realistically, it's good for the parent to tell the child, look, I appreciate everything you do, don't strain or whatever it is, but it's up to the child still to figure out what the parent wanted. The child isn't exonerated from the responsibility to focus on the relationship by the fact that the power of attorney says, so to speak, no birthday parties or whatever it is. Yes, Sammy.
Is there online source for, you know, keeping care of yourself?
Yes.
Does that apply to the worker also? Because, you know, the worker, actually dealing with the person with dementia, they suffer from burden.
Yep.
So I'm just wondering how you, you know, on one hand you have the spirits, on one hand the employee relationship, and on the other hand, you have,
right,
you know, working the worker and their own mental. Like, you understand?
Yes. Now, so Sammy asks about the caregiver's mental health and the need for the caregiver to look out for himself or herself, and that's certainly true. Everyone has to do that. The difference is, as you note, the caregiver is contracted to give a service. To a certain extent, when they sign on, they're agreeing to do something. Now, in Jewish law, employees generally are at-will employees, meaning that they give notice and say, I can't do this anymore. Then they walk away, assuming that they're not leaving someone in a lurch where there is no care for an immediate need. You know, they're licensed to do that. They won't get paid, you know, for going forward, but that's the way it works. Yeah.
So you gave the example of a child who wants to take care of his or her parent.
Yeah.
And the parent says that they cannot handle it. What about if it's the reverse, and the child wants the mother and father, and sees that they ought to go into a home for whatever reason, for dementia or whatever, the parent who's still alive says no. The spouse says no. For whatever reason, whether they feel that they can take responsibility realistically or unrealistically, they still want that their spouse to be in the home. So you've got the will or the wish or the desire of the parent and the spouse, and versus what the child wants.
Right.
And who knows which one is realistic and practical, but they're at loggerheads with each other.
Right.
So
this is, you know, this is the case always in Jewish law. The person who is on the scene has to be the one to make the assessment. And if it's the child who's going to be the one who's going to bear the brunt of it and be the one who's going to have to take care, then the child is not only within his rights, but it's his responsibility to say, there's a limit to what I can do, and at this point we really need to work with the facility. For that matter, let's take the child out of the picture, and maybe this is where you're going. Let's say the parents are living independently. The parents have an apartment somewhere, and the child who's living elsewhere sees that the father is no longer really focused, and you can give all sorts of permutations on this from actual cases. The father is trying to go driving or whatever it is, and the child is afraid for the safety of the parent. And again, I would say, where the child is afraid for the safety of the parent, they're falling in the home, they're trying to drive, they leave the stove on, whatever it is, then I think it's the child's responsibility to move to get care. If they can get in-home care that they'll be comfortable with, then of course that's better. But if they resist the in-home care and say, I don't want someone in my apartment, or if you can't afford that kind of care and therefore need to resort to a facility, you know, you're saving their life. And fundamentally, and that's the point that we had mentioned before, saving a person's life overrides their objections. And so that's what would have to happen. You know, you want to err on the side of satisfying what they want, but at the end of the day, their life has to come first. And I realize it's much easier for me to stand here and say that than it is to practice it. You know, I've been involved in cases of trying to get someone to stop driving, and I've never seen an easy one. Having said that, you ask me what the rule is, I think that's the rule.
Navigating the care of a dependent parent seems to me to have many infractions of people. The end point of putting the parent in restraint in order to feed them, and the advice was that required, you know, change of professional. But way earlier on along the continuum, there's things like a demented parent will say, where's daddy? And I will say, daddy went to the doctor, because that will not upset my demented mother. That's an okay to say to her, even though he didn't go to the doctor. He's out having his time out. I would never notice that to a different parent.
Right.
To me, it feels like a horrible thing. How much did the cleaning lady cost? The cleaning lady cost what my father paid, but I paid the cleaning lady on top of that. And
right.
These are not things that earlier would ever have occurred.
Right. That's an interesting point. And it's one that I want to think about before fully responding. So this one I'm going to send an email out about when I've had a chance to think it through. But let me just frame the question for those who couldn't hear, because it's a really good question. I gave a dramatic case of kibud av ve'em, of having difficulty honoring one's parents. I gave the dramatic case in which you have to restrain the parent in order to feed them. But it's true that there are milder things that go on earlier, such as the need to be dishonest, right? And the need to say to them something that isn't true simply because it will calm them down. And the question is that already a violation of honoring one's parent? I'm not sure. I want to think this one through, because we have a principle in general, Talmudically, which is backed up by biblical cases, that says, Mishanin mipnei ha-shalom. You alter the truth in order to preserve peace, not in order to take advantage of somebody else's ignorance, but in order to preserve peace. Someone asks you, how do you like this shirt I bought? The answer is, nice. Because they already bought it. You know, I'm not talking about where it'll embarrass them if they go out and wear it and they'll look bad and whatever, then find some other way to burn the shirt. But the point is, we have this concept of deceiving, for lack of a nicer term, where it is accepted. And so the question is, would that be considered a violation of honoring one's parents such that you would say, well, better to put them in the home now rather than have to lie to them? My gut is to say it's not a violation of honoring them. They come away feeling good and nobody has been harmed and they're better off for it. But I want to think it through and respond by email. It's a really interesting question. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much.